Broadcasting live from South Texas, this is your Petardcast. I am your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce, and I'd like to thank you for spending 45 minutes you'll never get back listening to something that had no business ever leaving the cramped prison of my mind. I hope your enjoyment of the show will match my astonishment that you're listening to it. For the Petardcast sixth episode, we'll be joined by Sheck Baker, best known as New York City's original angry young man. He'll be discussing humor, fury, despair, and potatoes, and will engage in sketch comedy because I forced him to do it. We'll also be debuting a new feature, Received Ideas for a New Millennium, and Return to Naming of Parts. There will also be comedy or something so much like it that it can only be called bomedy or perhaps domedy. All that and my ongoing struggle to master technology easily understood by poorly educated orangutans on tonight's Petardcast, a banana peel dropped in darkness. From time to time here on the Petardcast, we'll be featuring a program note called Received Ideas for a New Millennium. In the 1870s, Gustave Flaubert was writing his novel Bouvard and Pécuchet, and in it the two main characters, who were these sort of ignorant bourgeois clerks, set out to create the ultimate reference book in which they would put all the wisdom of the world, until finally deciding that they already knew everything that was worth knowing, so there was no need to actually go out and find out anything about the world. In a sort of companion piece to Bouvard and Pécuchet, Flaubert prepared this dictionary of received ideas, which was the conventional wisdom of what he perceived as the French bourgeois at the time, and defined everything a proper person might need to know about these things. Catholicism, for example, the note is, has had a very good influence on art. Hermaphrodites arouse unwholesome curiosity. Try to see one. The policeman, the bulwark of society. Don't say the police, but the forces of law and order or the constabulary. It carries on in this vein, and it was basically just a little guidebook for what every decent person should think about things. The idea has always been very appealing to me, and I've kept notes for several years on a new millennial version of the Dictionary of Received Ideas. Not an idea completely of my own, of course. Lewis Lapham has many times riffed on this very idea with much better results. But anyway, the first installment of my notes towards received ideas for a new millennium. Africa, a disaster. Say that we must learn the lessons of Africa, even if you're not sure what the lessons of Africa are. Arabs, violent, anti-Semitic, categorized on census forms as white due to bureaucratic incompetence. Worship a bloodthirsty primitive god named Muhammad. There has always been violence in the Middle East, and there always will be. No point in working for a solution. Children. Say, I believe the children are the future. People should have more children. Impossible for those without them to understand why this is so. No one can tell you how to raise your children. Communism. A dead religion. Useful as a cautionary tale. Communism's failure proves the superiority of capitalism. If an idea does not succeed, it is because it's a bad idea. Works, quote, in theory. The opposite of communism is freedom. Computers. The salvation of mankind. Computers have changed everything and made the whole world better for everyone. Once, it seemed sensible to pour millions of dollars into computer schemes that, in retrospect, were invested in solely by greedy fools. Defense. Stress importance of national defense. Spend lots of money on it. The best offense is a good defense. Education. Education is almost as important as family. Decry the fact that public school teachers are ill-paid, but do not send your children to public schools. Education is training for career. Education should not be free. teachers' union is notoriously corrupt and selfish. Environment. It is important to save the environment because it contains entertaining animals and scenic vistas. Difficulty of balancing commerce and nature. Ideas to help the environment are impractical. Family. It is very important to have a family of the correct configuration. Constantly emphasize the vital necessity of family. A family consists of a female mother and a male father who are married to each other. Greatest blessing to have a family who gives you money. Greatest tragedy to have a family who asks you for money. France. Filled with socialists, rabble-rousers, backward-thinking unionists. Its survival as a world power is entirely thanks to American intervention. The French are all arrogant, pompous sex fiends. France is synonymous with Europe. God. God exists and wants us to be rich and happy. God protects America and, to a lesser extent, Europe and Canada. Insist on having a personal relationship with God. Religion is important, but not as important as spirituality. God's rules do not always apply to you. For everyone else, say, they're called the Ten Commandments, not the Ten Suggestions. Issues. Important to talk about the issues during an election. Politicians always try to avoid the issues. At other times, issues should not be dealt with. Say, that's a whole different issue, or I don't want to get into that issue right now. Journalists. Very important to a free society. Journalists are to be protected with a degree second only to politicians. Archaic image of the rumpled, chain-smoking sot has been replaced by sophisticated, urbane professional. Still, nothing they say is to be believed. They are filled with liberal bias. Men. Intrinsically different from women on every possible level. Attempt to understand these differences, but not to eradicate them. Money. Every waking hour should be spent at making money, but when asked, say, there is more to life than money. Also say, it's not about the money. Don't say what it is about. Sex. A thing of the past. Still important, although it's unclear why. Having sex shows that you have cheated death. Time. There never seems to be enough of it. Still, we have it much better than ancient peoples. They had no access to time-saving devices. Imagine how busy their lives must have been. Troops. You have to support them. War. America does not engage in wars. Remind people at every opportunity that Vietnam, Korea, etc. were not actually wars. Wars has been replaced by terrorism, which is an entirely one-sided activity. Women. Fact that women are treated with equals a testament to the magnanimity of men. To think there was a time at which women were discriminated against. Our younger viewers may not remember this, but Mel Gibson was once a very famous movie actor and was known not for making, primarily for making crazy anti-Semitic comments and threatening his Russian wife's life, but rather for appearing in films. The New York-born son of an Australian railroad worker who harbored some curious sentiments about our Hebrew brethren, Mel Gibson has since been transformed into a public figure that really we don't expect him to make movies. We just expect him to say crazy things. But that's all right because he has all the money he needs, having discovered that you can make a fortune by pandering to the religious right. But back when he was an actor, here's the names of some of the characters that Mel Gibson played in his storied career. Mel didn't really appear in as many films as I thought he did, but, you know, he appeared in enough that he was once considered the sexiest man alive instead of the craziest man alive. Mel only twice has played people who are last names, Scallop and Porter. Four times he has played people with titles, a Dr. Gibbon, a Detective Skinner, an Officer Cox in a TV show, which I was ignorant of the existence of, and in my favorite, Scott the Body Piercer. You know, you can really picture Mel Gibson as a guy named Scott the Body Piercer. Four times, also, he has played people who are things. Francis's father, a baseball player, bearded mechanic, that's a good one, and my favorite, anger management therapy patient. Once he played a person who was only a first name, that would be Hamlet. We're not really privy to Hamlet's last name. Maybe that was his last name. And, of course, he's played a number of tough guys, Brett Maverick, Dale Mac McCusick, and everybody's favorite, Mad Max Rockatansky, in three different Mad Max movies. By the way, Max Rockatansky, possibly the closest Mel Gibson has ever gotten to playing an ethnic character. And curiously, he has never, ever played anyone with a Jewish name. Plenty of generic wasps in the Mel Gibson oeuvre. Tim Melville, William Wallace. I know William Wallace wasn't really a wasp, but that name has later become very waspy. Frank Dunn, a Nick Marshall, a Guy Hamilton, a Benjamin Martin, Fletcher Christian. You can't get much more waspy than Fletcher Christian. Justin McLeod, a Jerry Fletcher, a Ray Henderson, two Ricks, Rick Jarman and Rick Monroe, and three Toms, Mullen, Garvey, and Craven, making Tom second only to, that's right, Martin Riggs, as the most frequently named character that Mel Gibson has played. He has never played a character named Mel. Like I said, not much ethnic going on in Mel Gibson's catalog. Gene Ryak is the closest that he comes. He did once play somebody with the vaguely quirky name of Ed Biddle in Mrs. Sofel, but you know, generally he doesn't go for the crazy stuff. Aside from Martin Riggs, he has played a number of people with titles. Captain Daniel McCormick, Captain Paul Kelly, a Lieutenant Colonel Hal Moore, and a Reverend Graham Hess, which sort of sounds like the perfect Mel Gibson role. You know, there's the Reverend showing his righteousness and desire to smite the Jews, the Graham giving it a vague sort of British colony feel, and the Hess giving it a kind of Nazi sternness that people have come to associate with Mel Gibson. God bless you, Mel. Keep making movies, or whatever it is you do these days. Dear Minnesota Twins, last September I took my two nephews to see a game at your ballpark. You lost this game to the Boston team by a score of 5-2, which rather tainted the family outing. In the future, please win your ball games when I am in attendance. Yours, Othar Hjalgrensted, ASME. Dear Target Stores, I enjoy shopping at your department store near my home. However, you do not carry model trains. The store that carries model trains is an additional trip of 1.3 miles. Please begin carrying model trains so that I do not have to travel the extra distance. Yours, Othar Hjalgrensted, ASME. Dear Cinnabon, I am allergic to cinnamon. However, I enjoy your store. Please alter your menu so that it is not so focused on cinnamon-flavored treats. Yours, Othar Hjalgrensted, ASME. Dear American Society of Mechanical Engineers, as a member of your professional organization for over 27 years, I fear that as an anagram, we lack punch. ASMEG, or ASMEG, sounds to my ear much more emphatic and dynamic. Please incorporate a related industry that would allow for this. I suggest Army Generals or Giga Manufacturers. Yours, Othar Hjalgrensted, ASME. Dear Liechtenstein, if I may be frank, maintaining a Grand Duchy in this day and age is a dreadful affectation. Please convert to a constitutional republic immediately, or at least a decent monarchy for the love of Pete. Yours, Othar Hjalgrensted, ASMEG pending. Dear Bert Bacharach, for many years I have enjoyed your song Heartlight. However, I feel that the instrumental break following the second verse features a somewhat awkward transition. Please rewrite it to correct this deficiency. Yours, Othar Hjalgrensted, ASMEG pending. Dear Internal Revenue Service, I dislike paying income tax. Please send me any informational pamphlets you might have on how I might avoid it in the future. Failing this, please have yourselves abolished, retroactively if possible. Yours, Othar Hjelgrensted, ASME, awaiting judge's decision. Dear Marion Bartlemy, I was rather fond of your former husband Donald's writing and saddened to hear of his passing. While recognizing it would be absurd to ask you to rejuvenate him from his death state and begin writing again, I respectfully request that you take up the profession of fiction and begin producing works identical to his. Yours, Othar Hjelgrensted, ASME. Dear Doodletown Depot, in light of the Target Corporation's repeated refusals to honor my requests, I must ask you to pick up their slack and begin carrying clothing, household goods, small electronics, cleaning supplies, sundries, and photo developing. Yours, Othar Hjelgrensted, ASME. Well, welcome back to the Petardcast. I am joined by our guest for this installment of the show, Mr. Sheck Baker. How are you, Sheck?
Oh, pleased to be here, as always.
As always?
Did you yes.
enjoy the last time you were on the show?
I'm extrapolating into the far future.
Fair enough. Into that far-flung day when Sharia law rules the land.
Oh, with any luck.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell our theoretical listeners who you are and what you do?
My name is Sheck Baker. I'm a failing freelance writer.
Best kind.
the only kind. Not quite true. Let's see. I also make web videos with friends of mine. They can be found at ny.channel101.com and the YouTubes, any number of other places.
You want to tell us about the most recent one that you did?
Well, let's see. Most recently, I co-wrote and cameoed in a video called Saving Love, which supposes that a Nirvana fan receives a time machine from a mysterious source and is able to travel back in time and live out the fantasy of killing Courtney Love, or at least abetting in her demise, but then learns that this has horrific implications for the future of grunge music.
It would also deprive the world of her highly entertaining Twitter feed.
Indeed.
As an aside, I watched your video that was in that same round of...
Oh, yeah, a different video.
Yeah. And what saddened me so much about it, I thought it was very funny, but the URL to link to it contains the word failed. Like, man, way to rub it in, Channel 101.
Oh, dear. Yeah, the Channel 101 experience. but it also contained the word – did it also contain the word top or no?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, a very distinctive title for the show that doesn't quite get as many votes as it needs to succeed.
Right.
Called the Top Failed. It's not –
kind of toying with your ego there with that one.
Backhanding, yeah. As always.
Mm-hmm. You live in New York?
I do. I live in Brooklyn, New York.
What part of Brooklyn do you live in?
I would say South Park Slope. If you're going to put a fine point on it.
I was, I just interviewed Paul Auster, the novelist.
Oh, my God. Well, the other Brooklyn, the well-known Brooklyn person other than me.
Right. Well, you know, his new novel is called Sunset Park. And
which is adjacent to my neighborhood. And I am sort of rearing to go at that book just to see.
I recommend it. I think it's very good. But when I was talking to Olivia last week, she said that's where she lives, is Sunset Park. Almost exactly where, the exact same area where the book is set. So.
I've been doing a lot of long walks around Brooklyn recently, and I just gone down the street that he described as the home street of those characters in the book, and I was like trying to remember like if that looked like a habitable street. I mean, it didn't. He was describing the area as a very poor area, and it seemed to me like more just industrial than out and out poor. Like, there's parts of Sunset Park that are poorer than the one that he was describing. Like, that's almost into the Park Slope area.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the building it was set in
was demolished, fell down. So one could imagine perhaps someone down on their luck living in a building like that. Mm-hmm.
What would you say is more important to being a comedy writer? Living in New York or being Jewish?
Oof, being Jewish. Definitely. Because most comedy writers live in Los Angeles. So,
well, that's true. most successful comedy writers live in Los Angeles.
Yeah, living in New York is like almost failure-level comedy writing.
Mm-hmm. But do you feel that being Jewish compensates for living in New York then?
It depends on which Jews you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think knowing the right Jews is more important than being Jewish yourself. And by the right Jews, I mean Jews that went to Harvard and wrote up for the Lampoon.
Right. And are currently on their way to Los Angeles to
Right, exactly.
I can testify that if there is one thing that does not help you in the comedy world, it's being Arabic. That's no help at all.
How many, other than yourself, how many Arabic extracted comedy writers can you name?
That would be zero.
Oof.
That would be absolutely none.
Big fish in a small pond, though, am I right?
What's that?
Big fish in a small pond.
The biggest, yeah.
You.
In fact, I would say a rising number of comedians and comedy writers of Muslim extraction. Like there's Aziz Ansari and, you know, there's a lot of, but they're all, Pakistani, you know, and,
Iranian.
Yeah. And boy, you want to really get an Iranian pissed at you, tell him he's Arabic. He will punch you in the face. But
I'd like to see that happen to some preeminent, white people on the political scene.
Yeah. Who would not like to see that? Yeah. But, as far as, like, actual Arabs, we're just not, we don't have much clout in the comedy world, you know?
Well, you know, one day, keep at it.
There's still plenty of room for us in Hollywood playing terrorists, you know?
Well,
so
true enough. I mean, Jews used to have to get into Hollywood by playing Indians, so.
Right. Yeah, I was actually just listening last night to, the audio commentary for the first season of Community, speaking of Channel 101, guys.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
And Dan Harmon actually hit on something that I somewhat embarrassingly find myself complaining about a lot, which is that Arabs never get cast in Arab roles, except unless they're terrorists, you know, like. And
right.
I remember thinking, you know, oh, I wish they could have gotten an actual Arab to portray Abed instead of
yes.
an Indian, you know.
They tried.
Right, and that's the thing. He said, like, we try so hard to do this right, you know, and I mean, not to complain about Danny Pudi's performance, which is phenomenal.
He's terrific.
Yeah.
He's one of the best things about a show that is full of good things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about him, you know, he's a great choice, but, like, even I remember a few years ago there was a movie came out which I seem to want to say was called Raghead or Towelhead, and it was about the experience of this young teenage Arab American girl, and you know, facing prejudice, you know, because of her ethnic background. And even there, they cast an Indian girl in the role, and I was like, this movie is specifically about like being Arab American. Would it really have been so hard to find an Arab American girl to play that role? But how do I know? I don't know what the fuck goes on in the background there. Maybe they tried like hell and just couldn't find anybody, you know?
Well, you once created a taxonomy of wrestlers purporting to be Arabic and whether their origins were actually Arabic.
I did, quite a few of them, actually. I was a little surprised at how many of them
were. How many? Even though it was a tiny percentage.
Mm-hmm. And almost all Lebanese, you know, Christians. So not exactly, you know, the stereotype of the Arab.
Well, you know, the good kind.
Right. The ones who worship God as, you know, as God intended.
Exactly. Well, I mean, have you ever undertaken a similar task for Arab American actors?
No, but I can say pretty safely that almost all of the roles, like I said, like unless it's a terrorist, If you see a character in a TV show who is purported to be Arabic, they're almost always either Israeli, and like Jewish Israeli, not Arab Israeli,
right?
Or they're Indian or Pakistani or some kind of.
Or do they turn out to be like Mizrahi Jews, like from Arab countries, but their families have been deported and stuff like that?
I don't know. It's usually Oded Fair types, just kind of Arabs who are, or Israelis who are willing to play Arabs,
But with the guy who is the True Lies guy, was he like, I think he's, what is he? Is he Indian? I'm forgetting now.
I really don't remember who that was. He was playing a terrorist, so he might actually be Arab. So,
right. I don't think he was, though, was the thing. They couldn't even find an Arab to play the Arab terrorist in that.
Tony Shalhoub, of course, is genuinely Arabic and, actually gets cast.
Oh, really?
Well, I'm just saying, he's he's one of the few who's been allowed to pass through into the realms of normal people,
Light-skinned Arab.
Well, most Arabs are light-skinned.
No.
I know. Crazy, right?
Please. Art Malik is the man I'm thinking of.
That's definitely an Arab name. But then again, he could be Indian, and just have an Arabic name. So
he could be jazz musician for all of
that. That's right. Yeah, he could be African American. Let's look into that. That's our goal for today.
Homework.
Okay, back to comedy for a moment.
Okay.
Because I think we got somehow strayed away from that topic.
I love straying, though.
What is funnier, Sheck Baker?
Mm-hmm.
Anger or despair?
Oof. I lean heavily on anger.
I know you do.
But I would have to say, despair is a more in-depth kind of. I think you can mine deeper humor from despair than you can with anger, but it's a lot more hard, which I think makes it somewhat more desirable as something to aspire to. Like humor from despair is, I don't know, it's either almost too easy or too hard. There's very little in between. It's either like too, what's the word I'm looking for? It's
cheap
or whatever. It's like the kind of mash types of humor.
Oh, mawkish.
Yeah, mawkish, definitely. Whereas anger is like almost automatically funny, even accidentally.
Right. Maybe even especially accidentally. Yeah, I think I agree with you insofar as you take a guy like Bob Odenkirk and have him yell. That's funny, and it doesn't even matter what he's yelling about, But I think anger is a more fleeting emotion, whereas despair
is forever.
Despair, you can set up a whole universe of why you can get humor out of despair.
Yeah, which is why it's harder, because you have to set up a whole universe.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we were comparing, Todd Margaret style, the humor of despair to, say, a Lewis Black monologue.
Right.
One of them takes a lot more work both to enjoy and to create.
Right. Yeah, I think that may be why, kind of the humor of humiliation and despair is almost not really a recent development in overall culture, but it's only recently seemed to catch on, because there's so much work behind it.
It's a little faddish, really. It's weird how – I think we can thank Ricky Gervais for almost single-handedly bringing that to the forefront of comedy.
Yep.
Like the peeking through your fingers at it. And that's a hard line to straddle because, too much of that is unbearable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I've turned things off because it was just too cringe-inducing. I don't want to cringe.
I need
a release quickly if I'm going to be cringing.
Yeah, to me, the line is you have to at some point draw back from it a little. You have to leaven it a little, or else it stops being the comedy of humiliation and it starts just being humiliation.
Yes, exactly.
You're just watching someone suffer,
Right. And I mean, that's rarely amusing, even if it's someone I don't like or an archetype that I dislike.
Yeah, I mean, there are moments in the UK office that are just about hard, they're so hard to watch, and he has a gift, I think, for bringing it back from the brink, at that last moment before you go, oh, I can't even take this
Right.
anymore, but it skirts awfully close, to
Not
that.
to be not to be, too what are obvious or hoity-toity about it, but like Shakespeare did basically the same thing, only he wasn't like dealing in comedy mainly.
Right.
Like he knew how to do that in a tragedy, which is a magic trick.
Yeah, Shakespeare's comedy was all about dick jokes, really.
Yeah, or like, dudes in dresses, things like that. Which must have been a lot harder to pull off with dudes playing every single role. How do you do that? Like you're asked to suspend two levels of disbelief while watching that.
Well, surely, though,
I'd
you would
make
admit that
that
it was worth it to keep women out of show business.
Oh, thank goodness, God. Am I right? Those people aren't funny.
Right. Let's confirm once and for all, folks. Women are not funny.
Right here at 3:57 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Right. It's written in stone now. There's no going back.
I'm hewing into stone as we speak.
Right. Well, as you may know, sometimes on the show we ask people to defend a historical atrocity that they had nothing to do with.
I've been drooling at the anticipation.
Have you really? I feel like I'm serving you up kind of a softball here, but
Oh, don't do that. Well, too late.
well, I'm going to ask you to make lemonade out of the bitter lemons that are the Irish potato famine. As you may know, during a critical period in Anglo-Irish history, there was the Irish were producing potato crops for largely British consumption, and thanks to a combination of few bad growing seasons and some short-sighted British economic policies, even though food was plentiful in the British Isles, it was kept away from the native Irish, with the result that hundreds of thousands of people died of starvation in on the Emerald Isle. So, Shaq Baker, what are you going to do about that?
What am I going to do about it? Well, for one thing,
What
I
do you
mean,
have to say about it?
let's first examine the numerous benefits of the Irish potato famine. First of all, depleting Ireland, a beautiful, beautiful country, of the many Irish people.
Who really only ruin it, you know?
Anytime you put people on something beautiful, they manage to, build something atrocious upon it. So
Like the potato farm.
at any rate, ugh, tell me about it. They delayed Ireland's, inevitable descent into Blade Runner-ish 21st century dystopia.
So you're saying that had these Irish potato farmers been allowed to eat and not starve to death, that Dublin today would be like
Just a rainy, robot-infested
Right.
shithole. That's
Yeah, with
exactly what I'm saying.
constant gunfights, and
Gunfights with hilarious-looking guns,
yeah.
wielded by detectives wearing 1940-ish garb for some reason.
So more or less like Hong Kong is today, in other words.
I don't know. I feel like that's another discussion for another time.
All right, fair
We can
enough.
talk about James Clavell's many, many obsessions at a different date.
All right. What else you got?
Let's see. Well, to divert, I don't remember who it was, but at some point, someone had just about convinced me that the Irish potato famine referred not to a dearth of potatoes, but to a famine that destroyed all crops except for potatoes, and that the tragedy was that only potatoes could be consumed for a number of years. So
That's not
whoever managed.
entirely un incorrect, but the problem was that the potato was all being sent to Britain.
England, yeah.
Yeah, so they were being consumed, but not by the Irish.
Well, let's see. Let's also pick another benefit that many of the best and brightest Irish people were shunted overseas to the United States.
That's right. It did trigger a massive influx of Irishmen to the United States.
And with Irishmen come Irish jeans. And with Irish jeans come redheads, which, as we all know, the comeliest of lasses.
Hot stuff. Yeah, hot stuff. Also, you know, a bunch of Irish people showing up in America took the pressure off black people for a while.
For a little bit, until the 30s.
Right.
It shored up the police forces anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, it gave genuine white people a new group to dislike, you know. And let's, you know, let's not, you know, not to do your job for you, but, you know, let's be honest here.
You're ready to take over nonetheless.
Kept a lot of English people alive, you know. I mean, deserves to eat more, an Irishman or an Englishman?
Well, considering what the English would have done to the food. Am I right? Terrible.
Zing.
But I don't know how many. I mean, would we have been deprived of Paul McCartney or Ian McKellen or any number of Irish English actors and entertainers? I don't know. They might have been stuck in some Dublin clover factory. Right? That's what they do, right?
They make clover in factories?
I would imagine. I've never found a four-leaf clover on its own.
So your guess is that they are, you know, made by hand.
Well, the Industrial Revolution and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
Look.
Okay. Anything else?
I skipped that part of the AP history exam.
Any other benefits you would say to the mass death of hundreds of thousands of Irishmen?
Distribution of untold amounts of, you know, very bad Munster cheese.
I hadn't thought of that one. Are you saying that it increased the amount of Munster cheese or decreased it?
I think it increased. I would say it made Munster cheese so widely available that it could be mass produced by Kraft.
Okay.
In slice form.
All right. And that was and would you say that's an overall good for humanity?
I'm going to say it's a push.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Well, once again, I appreciate it. You know, our job on this show is to rescue, you know, the positives from the so-called negatives of history, and I think you've done a good job there.
I tried my best. I don't know, Irish people, am I right?
Yeah, well, they're not going to appreciate this because they're a naturally stubborn people, but... We tried. That's, you know,
stubborn but musical.
The history of the world is, you know, other people trying to help out the Irish and the Irish not appreciating it.
I can only assume you're going to wrap this up and mail it to Dublin after it's done.
I'm going to do a live reading of it on a street corner.
Oh, well done.
All right. Are you ready to have a dialogue?
Sure.
All right. Let's do that. MacArthur Fellowship Foundation.
Yeah, is this where you get one of them genius grants?
We don't actually like to call it that, but yes.
I want to apply for me one of them.
What is your field of research?
You mean, what kind of genius am I?
Sure.
I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure I'm a genius, though.
Well, what's your IQ? Have you ever had an IQ test?
I got me a 62.
Oh.
That's good, right?
Not really.
Oh, I thought anything over 30 was genius.
It's anything over 130.
Oh. Well, what about, like, if I was a physical genius?
Well, if you have an exceptional talent, we do have a program for,
I can do this thing where I throw things up in the air and catch them.
Juggling?
No, I, like, throw them up in the air and catch them, like, keeping a bunch of them going at once.
That's juggling.
Well, I don't know what you call it. I'm not a word calling it kind of genius. I'm a throwing and catching kind of genius.
Well, how many things can you juggle at once?
Three.
Three.
Well, up to three.
That's not really genius level. A lot of people can juggle three things.
But I can do that with anything. Balls, soup cans, videotapes.
How about concrete blocks?
Hell no, mister. I ain't Superman.
I don't think you can qualify at that level.
All right. Well, what about political genius? I got all kinds of solutions to world affairs and whatnot.
Hit me.
Well, okay. I think the queers ought not to be so up in your face with their carrying on. And if you don't like it here, you can just go get on back to where you came from.
It's pretty well traveled, sir.
Well, you want to hear how unemployed people ought to get themselves a job?
I don't think we can help you.
Well, God damn it. I know I got some kind of genius over here. My ma always said so. So what if I just get one without having to say anything or do anything?
What do you mean?
I mean, what if I was to say I have some special genius for something, but it's so goddamn special I can't even do it or show it or say what it is or anything. So people should ought to just sit back and kind of bask in it on account of it being so special and ineffable and so on.
Oh, you want the poetry grant? I'll send you an application. Thus ends the latest edition of the Petardcast. Thank you to Mr. Sheck Baker of New York for subjecting himself to this ordeal by foolishness. If you'd like to learn more about Sheck, ask your local librarian and see where that gets you. Please do stop by for the next edition of the show, where we'll be satisfying the terms of a number of lawsuits by delivering another batch of comedy, celebrity news, disturbed ravings, and another special guest who will make you plots, schwitz, and slivovitz. As always, prospective guests may email me at guests@ludiclive.com. And if you'd like to get the Petardcast free of charge each and every week, you can subscribe on the iTunes Music Store. We welcome your emails at info@ludiclive.com. This episode is dedicated to Mr. Charles Pooter and Mr. James Lilex. Thanks to you, the listener, and whatever combination of misfiring neurons and blows to the head resulted in my wanting to do a podcast in the first place. I am your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce. And don't forget to tip the monsters who live under your bed. They'll be there all week.